Hi, everyone. We have an exciting interview today with Steve Duffy from Trial Behavior Consulting. He's a really cool guy and very informed about juries and trial behavior. Before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about this season. In our jury breaks, we've talked about the common conspiracies behind Marilyn Monroe's death, but there's a reason I chose her psychiatrist to be the defendant in this season's trial. Actually, there are many reasons. It was her psychiatrist that was on the scene the night she died. It was her psychiatrist that hired the housekeeper that washed bed linens when police arrived. It was her psychiatrist that called the authorities. It was her psychiatrist that told police he called the publicity department at Fox before calling them. And craziest of all, it was her psychiatrist's relationship with Marilyn Monroe that captivated me more than anything. This quote-unquote therapeutic relationship was so odd. I've never been able to stop thinking about it. He described his role with her as the good father. He was involved in every aspect of her life. He arranged a spy to work in her home. And there's this alleged film of confessions she made for the psychiatrist in the months before she died. Somewhat confessions, just truths and stream of consciousness, but a lot of very, very personal information was apparently divulged. And she was wearing underwear in these tapes, or on this film, I should say. The entire concept of what the two of them were together is just fascinating to ignore. In the following episodes, we'll learn more about Ava's therapeutic relationship with Dr. Stowe. It is modeled on that of Marilyn Monroe, and through understanding their relationship, we'll begin to understand motive in the context of this season. Concurrently, and as always, in our show, we're exploring the jury process. This season is unique in that it's the first that's sequestered, and the way juror dynamics affect verdicts is our goal. Ours together. What we do is use fiction to figure that out. Today we're talking to Steve Duffy, who figures it out by other methods. Today we are speaking to Steve Duffy with Trial Behavior Consulting. They do a great deal of pretrial research, meaning focus groups, mock trials, other methods, as both a core service and one that provides a great deal of insight into how jurors act. Trial Behavior Consulting is a really impressive company. They're a company of consultants and researchers who are leading experts on juries and jury behavior. They evaluate and advise on jury selection and even interview jurors after completed trials. They understand jury behavior extraordinarily well, which is why I'm so excited to conduct this interview today. Steve, thank you for joining us, firstly. Hi.
Hi. Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. The first thing I wanted to ask you is, why is it important for attorneys to hire trial consultants?
Sure. So I think, you know, we use a phrase, which is that attorneys are often too close to their case. And that's by virtue, one, of the fact that they live with it day after day, you know, often for years on end. They can become sort of enamored with it or blind to certain aspects of it. And two, because they, you know, they're lawyers, right? So a lawyer's understanding of a case is inevitably going to be rooted in their understanding of the law. And their understanding of the law is much more nuanced and much more in depth than an average person. And average people are the ones who ultimately sit on juries and decide, you know, how a trial is ultimately going to come out. So our job, sort of writ large, is to provide a social science perspective rather than a legal perspective that allows lawyers to, hopefully get an understanding of how actual people who, you know, don't necessarily track or delve into the nuances of the law will feel about their case. So I think that's you know, a very broad answer. You know, I think the other, from a high level advantage, a jury consultant can bring to a case is that we tend to work on a much higher volume of cases than lawyers do. You know, most people probably don't realize that, you know, most lawyers only work on, you know, most litigators, I should say, you know, only work on a couple of cases a year, a few cases a year. You know, someone who retires after 35 years of practicing law, you know, may only have 70 or 80 jury trials under the belt by the time they retire. Whereas jury consultants, and it tends to vary, you know, by consultant, but, you know, we typically work on dozens of cases a year. And we also tend to work on a wider range of cases, and that includes criminal cases and also many types of civil cases. And you know, and that gives us a little bit of advantage just because it's easier, you know, when you work on more cases and different types of cases, you know, helps to draw parallels from, you know, one type of case to another, or, you know, just being more aware of things that have been tried in other types of litigation that you could benefit from in whatever case it is you're working on.
These days, we get practically everything on demand. Like deliberations, which you can listen to whenever you want, whenever is convenient for you. You can also download media or order products whenever you want. Did you know you can even get postage on demand? All you need is Stamps.com. Stamps.com brings the post office right to your desk. Here's what happens. Stamps.com sends you a digital scale, and then you weigh your letters into packages and print the exact amount of postage you need for any letter, any package you want. It's so easy. You just click, print, mail, done. Recently, I was leaving town, and I waited until the last second to mail this work document, which was very important and so very naughty of me. But because of Stamps.com, I was able to print my postage at night and get it in the mail before I had to leave for the airport early the next morning. It really saved me. It's perfect for people with limited ability to run errands or anyone who wants the flexibility to mail things when and how it suits them best. It's amazing. Right now, use Deliberations for this special offer. A 4-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deliberations. That's stamps.com and enter Deliberations. Thanks so much, you guys. Back to the show.
It seems like a very interesting process. When a client hires you, your company, what does that process look like? Meaning, how do you go from the date of hire to the date when all jurors are seated on your client's case?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. I mean, the answer is we can get involved really as early or as late as an attorney or a client is willing to get us involved. You know, sometimes we'll get a call, you know, on like a Friday and say, "Hey, I've got a jury pick on Monday. Can you come?" That's pretty late in the game to be getting involved. You know, but there's other times where we get involved in cases when, you know, they're in very preliminary stages, discovery still being conducted, if it's a civil matter, you know, where there's a lot of uncertainty about how the case is going to get worked up. And you know, in those instances, I suppose I'll start there just because that'll sort of give the full gamut of how we could be involved in the length of a case. So if we get involved early, oftentimes it'll be to conduct pretrial research. There's generally two forms of that. One is a focus group, which is basically a discussion in a room or multiple discussions in multiple rooms with the moderator, where you're asking, you know, mock jurors just participants how they feel about the background of a case or certain topics that are involved, how they're perceiving certain evidence. It's very exploratory. If you're a little closer to trial, you'll often use a form of pretrial research. It's called a mock trial. And that's a more formal test of the trial where you're basically taking a 2 or 3 week trial and you're condensing it into a day, maybe a day and a half. You're having attorneys do presentations, for both sides, be it plaintiff and defense or prosecution and defense. And
wow.
Then you're
I'm sorry to interrupt, yeah. but that sounds like that's a lot more of condensing than I would have anticipated.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it's budgetary. It's that stuff can be very expensive. I've done multi-day mock trials where you spend 3 days, maybe 4 days, but the vast majority of mock trial exercises are in a single day.
How do you decide what material makes it into that that time frame?
Yeah, so it's one of those things where I've been doing it long enough where it seems secondhand, but yeah, I get that that might seem bizarre to someone who's never done it before. Really, it's not even a day because you need to have a significant portion of the day reserved for deliberation. So you're probably only talking about in a full day exercise 3 or 4 hours of actual presentation time. Really what you want to do is hone in on the most critical elements of the case. Oftentimes we'll just do, what we'll call closings, which are, hybrid of opening and closing statement. They're opening statement in the sense that they are the first time these people are going to have heard something about the case. They're closing in the sense that they're allowed to be argumentative rather than just a preview of what the evidence is allowed to show, which is typically the case in an opening statement. So you'll have both sides give a closing. Typically the plaintiff for a prosecution gets to have a rebuttal as well because they are the ones with the burden of proof. And that is often the most efficient way to condense things. So you're not you're obviously not going to play them hours and hours and hours of witness testimony. That's just not how you do it. It's really more the attorneys presenting and saying, so-and-so said this, so-and-so said that, here are the key arguments. Now, you can weave in witness testimony into that process, or you can even show certain witnesses for 20 minutes at a time during the process. But you just don't have the luxury of showing hours of witness testimony. So when you do that, you really want to pick on the most crucial witnesses and then really identify and isolate their most critical testimony. That's how you typically do it. At the end of the day, you have jurors, typically after rebuttal, you have them fill out a questionnaire. How are they feeling about the case? How would they decide the verdict in that moment in time? That way you get a really nice read of the individual's perspective of the case before they've been influenced by anybody else. And then we'll usually break them up into groups, into juries, and have them deliberate. So, you might be doing, if you're in a venue where, because jury size in criminal cases is always 12, in civil cases it can vary anywhere from 6 to 12. So let's say you're doing a criminal case, you might have two juries of 12, right? So you'll break the jurors up into two groups of 12 and have them deliberate, and then see how how things change in deliberations, right? Which side has the most effective arguments and are able to move, which side's advocates are able to move the other sides towards their position, how are the dynamics of leadership influencing the room? Which is often, and that's one of the reasons why when you do mock trials, you typically want a minimum of two juries. Often, you want 3 or 4 if you can have it, because there's small sample size in that you've got just one jury, and you can get a really aberrant result from any group of 12 people or 6 people or 8 people. And on top of that, in part that's because leadership is such a crucial factor. So if you have you take the 11 same people and you put them in a room with one person who's got great leadership and is very prosecution oriented, you might get a very prosecution oriented outcome. But if you flipped it and put a very defense oriented leader in there, you might get the opposite outcome.
Right.
So doing multiple juries allows us to account for the variance in how that stuff plays out.
Wow, leadership is such an interesting topic that you raise, and I mean, it seems integral with any jury process. Have you noticed any patterns that emerge in terms of who becomes leaders in these rooms?
Yeah, I think, you know, that, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, and so, you know, after mock trial process, we can be involved in many steps, and I'm sure we'll get back to in a minute. One of those is picking juries, where we'll assist counsel with actually selecting, or it's really deselecting the jury, because you don't, you know, it's a common misconception that you pick jurors like the NFL draft, right? It's not with the, you know, the first pick in the NFL draft, the Cleveland Browns select Baker Mayfield. That's not how it works. It's with your first strike, you get rid of so and so. And so when you're picking a jury, you really need to be evaluating people on two fronts. One is their likely orientation, right? Are they likely to be good or bad for my client? But the other, and in some ways most important factor, is how likely are they to be a leader in the room? Because, you know, I might live with someone who I'm not crazy about, but who I think is going to be a follower. But if there's someone who I have a funny feeling about, and they're a leader, that they have to go. They must be struck. What do you look for in terms of leadership? It tends to be, traditionally, it was people who were older, people with high educational and economic attainment, right? Oftentimes it would be the oldest, the sort of most, you know, one of the more senior, most accomplished people in the room. So that's still true to an extent. The other thing you look for is how verbal are jurors in jury selection. You know, typically jurors who are volunteering and talking a lot in jury selection are going to talk a lot in deliberations. Now some personalities that talk a lot may really rub other people the wrong way and thus be less likely to be leaders. So you've got to parse apart the wheat from the chaff. This is a bit of a wormhole, but you know, one really interesting thing we've seen in the last 10 years, and this is both true in terms of seated juries on where we picked juries, but also even in mock trials, because when you have a mock trial, you still have a four person. It's just a mock four person. Is that young people are now seeing young people act as four person, which is a huge departure from years past, and I think it is really. I know everybody likes to hate on millennials, but it really is, I think, a function of how millennials have been raised.
Right.
With social media, right? In generations past, young people were not necessarily comfortable expressing their opinions. They were generally deferential to experience and expertise, and with the advent of the internet and the ability to find information at the click of a button is really, I think, devalued.
Oh, right. Like social media has made millennials very comfortable expressing their opinions.
Yeah, there's a distinction now where young people are, young people in this generation, meaning people between 20 and 35, are comfortable expressing their opinion and taking on a leadership position in a group of other adults who are often older in a way that just never happened before.
Right. Which is, that's amazing.
Yeah. And so it's changed the way you approach jury selection, because in the past, right, I mentioned leadership is something you're really focused on. In the past you would typically discount anyone who was relatively young from having a lot of leadership in the jury room, becoming four person, and you just can't do that anymore because you very well could be wrong. Right. So that's, again, a bit of a tangent, but I think one way.
I love tangents. One way what?
Yeah. Well, just one way in how evaluating leadership and likelihood of leadership has changed.
Right.
The age component just isn't as important as it used to be.
Do you find that the gender component is also evolving? Like, are women more now likely to become leaders in these types of deliberations environments than men?
Is, you know, that's an interesting question. I will tell you that.
It's a hopeful question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the interesting thing is most jury, and I don't have the data in front of me, but I can only tell you from anecdotal experience that most juries are female dominant, or meaning female have at least 50% women, if not more. You know, there's probably a variety of reasons for that. In civil cases, plaintiff attorneys, and I've actually done some analytical research on this, tend to strike women at an elevated, or I'm sorry, tend to strike men at an elevated rate. So, you know, oftentimes when I'm picking a civil jury, it's very common to see a civil jury that has 75% women. Very uncommon to see a civil jury that has 75% men. You know, so, that's relevant just in the sense that I've never noticed a big bias in terms of four person along gender lines.
That makes me happy to hear.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's, you know, so I think in part that's just because juries tend to have lots of women on them.
Right. I mean, especially makes me happy. I've done some research on the likelihood of one person to be a four person versus another. And I think, and the research I did was a little while ago and it was probably antiquated. But I did see that, the uncomfortable truth is that it tends to be like middle-aged white men. And I'm like, oh, that sucks. And I'm not saying that that's, you know, verifiable information. You're the jury expert. But it makes me happy. It's gratifying to hear that it's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. I guess I'm at the very end of Gen X, so I'm not that old. You know, and I think if I'd been practicing in the 80s or even the early 90s, working in the 80s or even the early 90s, it may have been very different. But, I haven't noticed that anecdotally. I have not done large scale research about, gender and leadership, but certainly in recent years, I've not noticed a disproportionate number of four people, either in mock juries or on actual juries, being male.
Well, that's excellent. Okay, great. So you have this mock trial, which is a condensed version of the actual trial. You have as many mock juries as is possible. They deliberate, and then what happens?
Yeah, so then you'll take – and this is the same thing for the focus group, right? Whenever you do a research study, it's just as a little bit of context, most of the people who do what I do have graduate degrees in social science. So the most common backgrounds are psychology or communications or sociology. My background is actually political science, which is a little bit of an outlier, but there's a few political scientists who do it. So, you know, we basically are trained researchers, right? And so we approach any research study, the same way, which is let's take it apart and let's find out, what worked for one side, what worked for the other side, you know, how can we further capitalize on the strengths of our side? How can we shore up the weaknesses of our side? And then, you know, one of the things we look at is what traits, and attitudes are correlating with outcomes, right? So because we ask people a bunch of questions beforehand, akin to jury selection, and then they produce verdicts. And what you do is you take the background experiences and attitudes and you see what correlates with verdict outcomes. And that allows you to draft what we would call a jury profile, which is, basically a list of attributes that are going to correlate with plaintiff or defense or prosecution or defense support in the trial. So that provides a lot of insight in terms of jury selection about who you will or won't want on your jury. For example, you might find in a case involving, let's say there's a case that involves a violent crime. You might find that jurors who have had a loved one who's experienced violent crime are, disproportionately likely to be prosecution oriented, right? So if I'm on the defense side, I'm going to want to strike those jurors, that sort of stuff. Then you move forward. You may be involved helping with witnesses, which is, just where you'll sit in on the sessions where the attorneys are helping the witnesses to prepare for deposition. you know, to provide almost like a, that's almost like a doing clinical psychology work, depending on the emotional issue. You know, some, a lot of witnesses will have emotional issues about being involved in a case. You know, so helping them work through that so that, you know, for example, they're not, you know, they don't get extremely angry when they're on the stand, or they don't, you know, become, lose emotional control and start sobbing while they're on the stand, right? You, you're trying to you deal with their emotion often. So, and we don't, just to be clear, we often, when we get brought into a case, we're just doing one or two of these services a la carte. I'm just sort of going through the full gamut of them as if we were doing everything to give you the right. full perspective of what we do.
Right.
So you might help with witness preparation. There might even be another round of jury research if you did, you know, a mock trial early on, and then some things changed in terms of the way you expected the case to happen at trial. You might do another mock trial. As trial draws near, you'll usually meet with the attorneys. We'll consult with them on their opening statement, you know, and, or really just trial strategy in general. Here's what we think your key themes should be. Here's the evidence you really need to hammer on. You know, here are some ideas for some demonstratives or some, you know, some visuals for opening and closing. We'll typically draft voir dire, which is, voir dire is the oral part of jury selection where, the judge and the attorneys are allowed to ask prospective jurors questions. In federal court, sometimes it's only the judge, but in state court, typically everybody's allowed to ask questions. So we'll usually draft out the questions we want our attorneys asking. Then we will go with them to jury selection. We usually sit with the attorneys. We, you know, a big part of what we do in that environment is really just organization. You know, it can be very chaotic tracking the responses of, you know, often dozens of people at a time, particularly for the attorney who's having to stand up there and ask them questions. You know, so we help track who's saying what. Hey, you know, suggest follow-up. Hey, this person, you know, raised their hand to this. You never got back to them. You might want to ask them this. You know, so we help drive the voir dire process. And then when that's over, you actually select the jury. You know, often are, you know, making recommendations and driving the bus in terms of who to strike and you know, what decisions to make during the actual picking of the jurors or deselecting, as I mentioned earlier.
Right, which I imagine is the most critical part of it. Well, in my imagination anyway, it's the most critical part of any trial is the jury selection. Like, who composes those people who are going to be making the decisions? It is the single most important aspect in my mind.
I mean, I agree. I agree with you. I think, you know, you can't win a I mean, this is sort of a phrase you'll hear in the industry, but you can't win a case in jury selection, but you can lose it. You probably actually can win it in jury selection, but you can most definitely lose it.
Right.
You know, if you get, and there's just so much variance, and I think this is something we'll probably talk about a little bit more in depth later, but there's so much variance in terms of juries, right? And who ends up on your jury, and you know, and that can just have a hugely disproportionate outcome on, you know, the verdict.
Right. So what is the role of trial behavior consulting mid and post-trial?
Yeah, so that's, you know, we're typically not as involved as heavy during and after trial, but there are exceptions. So, you know, there are particular trials where we're working very closely with counsel, where we stay in the loop the whole time. We're involved in strategic decisions about, you know, which witnesses to call or what questions to ask them.
Are you, kind of wondered, are you the people sitting in the courtroom watching the jurors' faces?
So, I mean, we get asked to, we don't do that very often.
Okay.
We would call that like trial monitoring.
Right. Okay.
You know, the there's a disconnect between what we actually do and I think what the perception many people have of what we do is. You know, right. I know there's the show Bull on TV right now, which is really like a science fiction version of what we do. The reality is we're just a lot of nerds with post-it notes in jury selection. And, you know, we don't have like, you know, it's not like we're shooting biometric darts into jurors and then like, you know, divining what their verdict is going to be based on their blood pressure. Right. That's not how it works, at least not yet.
No, you'd be earning a lot of money if that were the case.
That's right. So, the sort of face reading or juror reacting aspect of it, I think that's something that people often think is very telling, but in my experience is often not that telling. A lot of people just have poker faces I know plenty of anecdotes from attorneys who will tell me, oh, this woman was smiling at me every day. And then, we got hammered and it turned out, she was the one leading the charge against us, or the opposite, person was giving me nasty looks. It turned out they were the best juror in the room for me. So while it's only natural for attorneys to read a lot into that, because their perspective, it's a very weird, they can spend weeks presenting their case and they get no feedback, right, from the group that's going to make the decisions on how well they're doing. So that's, it's only natural to read a lot into that, but
sounds terrifying.
There are exceptions, but often people read way too much into that stuff. If there's a juror who's like weeping uncontrollably when you have, the victim or the plaintiff or whoever on the stand, if you're on the defense side, that's generally not a good thing. And if you're on, the plaintiff or prosecution side, it's probably a pretty good thing. But, less overt body language and facial language, I just don't put a lot of stock in. I think you can get yourself really twisted if you pay too much attention to that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I clearly don't have as much experience as you, but I remember reading this book called Imperfect Justice by one of the attorneys on the Casey Anthony trial, and they were convinced that, the jurors, this one was on their side and this one wasn't, that this is one they thought was the leader called the coach and like yada, yada, yada. And then what they came to understand after the trial is that they were just totally wrong and just misreading it. And I imagine that's completely natural to do, especially if you're kind of projecting to an extent, which every attorney has to be doing somewhat.
Yeah, of course. And, the attorneys, litigators are – they're alpha personalities. They're extremely competitive. And so they all – well, not all, but it's just very easy for any attorney to fall in love with their case, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's inevitably going to color the way you perceive things like that.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Please go on.
Oh, no, I was going to say, so we'll often stay involved in sort of big picture and strategy, and then we'll often be involved in helping to put together a closing statement, just in terms of making it as jury friendly as possible. There's some other stuff. I mean, there's something called a shadow jury, which we will do pretty infrequently. But that's sort of a big production. I know that's been featured in the show called Bowl, where they refer to it as a mirror jury. That's where you actually you recruit people who are, similar to the seated jurors. I don't mean like they look like them, but, of similar backgrounds and live in the venue to go watch a trial, and you interview them at the end of every day. It's really an amazing thing because it gives you a real time perspective basically on how the case is coming in.
Right. That sounds like it would be highly effective. Is it?
It's extremely effective. It's also extremely expensive.
Yeah.
Very, 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 very effective in terms of, basically providing, I just mentioned, right, attorneys don't get that feedback. That's a way where they do. So if things look like they're coming in, really well, you may take a harder line in terms of the arguments you make, and you may push a harder position in terms of, whether or not you're trying to resolve how you're trying to resolve the case before it goes to a jury, because that's very common during trials, particularly civil trials, for them to settle during the case. A shadow jury can have a lot of a big impact in terms of how you are posturing in regards to potential settlement or potential have a plea in the middle of a criminal trial. They're very, very valuable, very, very expensive and complicated to put on. So we don't do them very often, but they're incredibly interesting when we do, because they just give – nothing gives you better insight into juror thinking and juror behavior than that.
Absolutely. That makes total sense.
Yeah. And then after trials, sometimes – and whether or not you can even legally do this varies state by state. But will at times be asked to try to contact the actual jurors in a case and interview them. So again, in some states, I know, for example, in Florida, you're not allowed to reach out to jurors unless they reach out to you. So meaning, you know, if at the end of a case, a juror walks up to one of the attorneys and says, "Hey, I thought you'd, you know, tried a really good case. I'd love to talk to you." Then that attorney can contact that person. But if that doesn't happen, you're not allowed to contact that person.
So you can walk up to a juror in a car park and say, "Hey, what went wrong?"
Not in certain places. So Florida being one, I tend to do a lot of work there. But in California, for example, you can I can figure out who was on a jury and call them and try to interview them about what happened. So that's called a post-trial interview. You know, typically you're asked to do that in cases where that are likely to be retried or where you're likely to have a trial that's similar in the future. Or if a client is just really befuddled by what happened and wants to get to the bottom of it.
Right. How educational are those experiences for you?
You know, they're actually, this is, they will tell you a lot about what happened in that case. They're not always as good at helping you with other similar cases or even a retrial in the future, because often the people you're talking to are the ones who want to talk to you, which means they're the people who are on your side in the jury room. And yeah, so a lot of times they've sort of chosen their side and they'll just tell you that everything you did was great. or if they didn't like you, they'll sort of shoot holes in everything. If you could do a bunch of them, if you could talk to five people, you know, six people, you might run into one or two people who can give you more of a nuanced assessment of things, and or just the aggregate of all the responses can help you understand maybe how to position things better in the future. But a lot of it's funny how often I've been disappointed where, the attorneys I'm working with will say, hey, I talked to one of the jurors, you know, I mentioned, you know, if they'd be open to talking to you for a little bit about their experience. I get really excited and then I talk to them and you know, I spend half an hour listening to them tell me how they thought everything we did was great, right? Which is not helpful, right? It's actually more important to know what we did wrong, right? It's not to say they aren't valuable, and they can be very valuable in terms of understanding, okay, what happened in the jury room, like which person took over and was really persuasive, right? That aspect of them are very helpful. But in terms of being forward thinking and forward looking, they're often underwhelming.
That's interesting to note. Yeah, and I imagine too, like sometimes just jury chemistry can play a huge factor in these outcomes, which, as you know, you sort of indicated, would not be helpful when it comes to being forward thinking and strategically planning for future cases.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing when you're picking a jury, one thing you should be thinking about is group dynamics, right? And similar groups are always going to be more prone to groupthink, which can be very dangerous if it goes south for you. So generally, you know, someone on the defense side of things will not want, you know, really homogenous juries, really of any demographic. You know, if you get, if you get a critical mass of similar people, be it in gender or age or socioeconomic standing or whatever, they're going to be more likely to see things the same way. And then they can, that's how people can talk themselves into crazy decisions, I think. So, you know, a defendant, either in a civil or criminal context, you know, a mistrial, no result is a win, right, on the defense side, because right. It means, you know, either you're not going to jail or you're not, you know, you're not paying money. When you're on that side of the fence, you don't necessarily want to look up and see a group of 12 people where nine of them look basically the same.
Right. That makes sense. I've heard the same argument, that of groupthink, put forth a lot when it comes to sequestering juries. Like anytime you just isolate a group of people together, you run the risk of of developing a groupthink dynamic.
Yeah, that's 100%. Sequestration is it's not something I've dealt with very much. It's on the wane. It does not happen very much anymore. One, for financial reasons. Two, the state, that's a lot of money for the state to be paying. Especially judicial budgets are very tight pretty much everywhere you go. The dockets are overloaded, the judges are overworked. So the budget is precious. But beyond that, I think, judges have sort of realized the toll that sequestration can take on individuals and that it can produce funny things. Certainly groupthink, the likelihood of having groupthink when you have a group of people living on the same floor of a hotel, for a month or two is only going to increase.
Absolutely. Have you ever consulted on a sequestered jury?
No, I have not. I think, they're pretty uncommon these days. I've obviously read about it, and thought about it from a social science perspective. My understanding, and again, I tend to work on a lot of civil matters to my knowledge, there's never been a civil jury that's been sequestered. I could be wrong. It tends to happen in high profile, high publicity criminal matters like the Cosby trial most recently.
Right.
But I think, what are the impacts of that? One, I think there's the impact on the individual, which I think is pretty unhealthy.
Sounds like prison. Strange...
Yeah. I mean, look at some of the reality shows that are on television where they take away people's phones, they take away people's TVs, right? They just sort of put them in a house with a bunch of other people and watch them go crazy, right? And
it's not funny. I'm laughing because of how terrible and absurd it is. But if you're right. It's an insane process.
Yeah, and so I don't think that's healthy for the individual. I don't think it's necessarily healthy for the group because of the groupthink reasons we've just sort of talked about. I think there's always pressure in a jury especially for anybody who's holding out. That's got to be magnified tenfold in a sequestered environment where you're literally keeping 11 other people from their families.
Oh God. Right?
By not agreeing with them.
Right. Like being at the holdout in general sounds so stressful.
Yeah. It's most personalities, will not hold up. And that's why you don't see many hung juries, quite frankly, because most people will just get worn out. And we see that in mock trials, which is just maybe 3 hours of deliberations. You'll see the one or two holdouts get worn down in an hour or two. It's very unusual. And I would think particularly in a sequestered environment for that to take place.
Interesting. I wonder how I would do as a holdout. I want to say that I would hold out to the end, but I really don't. I think I would cave when really, doing some self-examination.
Yeah, I think it depends on, it depends on the person. It depends on the topic. I mean, I think we all have certain things that are just lines in the sand for us. And if you're a juror on a particular case involves one of those lines in the sand, you're going to be more likely to stick to your guns.
That's true. There are some things that I would not cave on. That's a good point.
Right. Well, and also how much you care about the parties, right? And this is something that corporate defendants often have as a challenge in civil cases is, it's very easy in like a personal injury case, it's very easy for people to take the mantle of the hurt person. Defendants, I think, can often have trouble in deliberations because their advocates may not just care as much because at the end of the day, the party they're advocating for, even if they think in the right, is just some corporation. Not some injured person. Right.
That makes sense. Yeah. It's the nameless, faceless corporation. So how can I be as emotionally invested when I'm not personally, relating or identifying? How frequently, if ever, are you surprised or shocked by verdicts that are handed down on cases?
So I think there's some variance there. I mean, The more involved I am in a case, probably the less, especially if I know the jury, then I'm less likely to be surprised. You know, if I know the attorneys, I know the strengths and weaknesses of the case, I know, you know, the jury, then I'm less likely to be surprised. It doesn't happen. If I know all of that stuff, you know, it doesn't happen that often. There might be small surprises, right? Like there's a little, you know, a little variance in the outcome, but I'm talking like, oh, I thought it was going to go this way and it went completely the other direction. That's only happened to me, you know, two or three times in my career where I was just dead wrong. But you know, when it's just some case that you're reading about in the newspaper or some case that I'm, you know, hearing about on, you know, a website that tracks, you know, high profile litigation, then you can be surprised, I think, regularly.
Right. Cause you're not intricately involved and understand the nuances of that.
Yeah. You just don't know, you know, you don't know the details of who's involved, how good they are, what the jury looks like, all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So, but I would imagine you're probably less shocked than most in general when it comes to verdicts that are publicly announced. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you know, you know, sort of where we started our conversation, right, was the huge variance in, you know, the composition of CETA juries, and that produces just tremendous variance in outcomes. So, you know, that you're naturally going to be surprised, you know, by outcomes from time to time, given the nature of the jury system. It's just it's a function of the system.
Right. What, if any, and as you understand them, are the biggest, and I don't mean to take this necessarily to a dark place, but I have to ask because I'm consistently thinking about it and it's just a topic of interest for me. So what, as you understand them, are the biggest problems with our jury system?
So I think it's what, you know, it's a perfect segue, I guess, because it's what we're just talking about, right? It's the jury system using civil juries of regular people introduces tremendous variance in outcomes, because the composition of any given jury is so variable, right? It's variable based on what juror showed up for jury selection that day, you know, how the judge, you know, ruled in terms of who's going to be let go, you know, for what's called cause, which means their challenge for cause means their bias has been established by one of the parties. And then, you know, the skill of the attorneys in getting the jurors to open up and to know what to look for in terms of who to get rid of. There's just huge variation. And so, you know, that means that you have huge variation in outcomes in very similar cases. You know, and if you have five similar cases and you get five very different outcomes, you know, which one's the right outcome? It's not all five. So, yeah, it's, I mean, the jury system is inherently problematic in that respect, right? Now, there's real irony because the countervailing benefit of the jury system is that it provides, it means that regular people are engaging in the system and thus legitimizes it, right? If you had a criminal justice or a civil justice system that was determined only by judges, you might actually have more consistent and potentially just outcomes, mm-hmm. but the system would be perceived as less legitimate. You know, so jurors, which are the aspect of the system that make it more variable and probably less consistently just, are also what make it more legitimate. And that's, you know, a really interesting
thing
to think about.
Point. Because I've considered myself whether or not bench trials across the board would be a more just system for us. But the term legitimate is, it's a subjective term, I think. Yes?
So. Yeah. It's more difficult. It's difficult to be critical of a jury decision as being a product of corruption or political malfeasance or decay when... Yeah. Ultimately, it's decided by 12 people who live in your community, right? Yeah. Even though their decision may be, you know, quote unquote wrong, or more wrong than the decision given by a panel of judges. So there's, you know,
particularly that's such about, a good point. Yeah, it really does close off the opportunity for corruption.
I mean, mostly. I mean, it's, you know, you can still have corruption, and you know, certainly, judges introduce a lot of variability in the process. You know, there are very different in terms of how they lean and how they call balls and strikes. So it's not to say it's the only factor, but it's the biggest factor in variance. Now, I will say, that if I was being sued, or being tried for a crime, and I was truly in the right, I would be more comfortable with a bench trial. If I was in the wrong, I'd probably want to roll the dice and have a jury trial.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and it's a strange thing for a jury consultant, someone whose livelihood is dependent on the jury system, to say that. But again, I just think juries, because they're so different from one another and can produce such different outcomes, are just less consistent. And so if I know I'm in the right, I'm going to want the more consistent outcome.
Right. And if you know the law's on your side, you want someone who's very well versed in the law.
Right.
As opposed to maybe if you're definitely in the wrong and you're guilty of something, maybe you can play on jurors' emotions or facilitate some other, method of jury persuasion.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge piece of advocacy in the courtroom is, whenever an attorney says, and this is particularly in civil trials, like personal injury cases, we do not want your sympathy. You're not supposed to use your sympathy in the courtroom. That's typically a prelude to a 5-minute play on jurors' emotion and sympathy, right? It's sort of like when someone says no offense, whatever follows is naturally offensive.
Very offensive. Yeah.
when an attorney says in a courtroom, now we're not here to play on your emotions, they're about to play on your emotions.
Right. No offense, but do you really want to wear those pants?
right. I don't want your sympathy, but let me spend 10 minutes telling you about the horror of my client's life since she was injured in this accident.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a very powerful tool when you're dealing with real people.
Yeah.
And real methods of communication. And that's what this is all about. Well, this has been an extraordinarily illuminating conversation. You're an engaging interview subject. I think Trial Behavior Consulting sounds like a fantastic company. And you are obviously experts in your field. So I feel very lucky to have recruited you for this interview today. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Steve, if people want to learn more about you or Trial Behavior Consulting, how can they do that?
Sure. They can just look us up on the web, trialbehavior.com. We tend to work, on higher profile cases. So, we're generally not the ones you want to be calling. Well, really individuals who are involved in litigation are, not the ones who reach out to us. It's typically lawyers, occasionally their clients, but,
we got lawyers who listen to the show.
Great. I'm sure you do.
I'm being somewhat playful, but I do think that there are things even lay people could learn from viewing your company website.
Yeah. And then, if you want to just learn about jury consulting in general, you can use the Google machine. There's the Association of ASTC. I'm gonna move this now that I'm put on the spot. It's the
American Society of Trial Consultants.
Thank you very much. Their website.
Yeah, no.
A lot of really good content.
It's funny you mentioned them because I actually interviewed Patty Keene, the president of ASTC as well.
There you go. Yeah. So that's, for sort of some background in the industry and just some insight into what we do, that's that's a really good place to start.
Yeah, there's a lot of helpful information there. So it's nice to hear that you are a member and an advocate, because it seems like that's really, really important work, what you do within your company and what you do within that organization as well.
You know, we like to think so.
Well, like, you know, something that Patty said to me actually is really the basis of what we do is we're just trying to make the justice system as fair as possible. Like, your roles in this system is to help things be to facilitate fairness at every opportunity and to keep the balance in play.
Yeah, I mean, you know, most of the trials I work on, there's consultants on both sides. So it's not, you know, it's not like one side. And one side doesn't have a consultant, it's usually a choice. You know, the attorneys don't want to work with a consultant, don't think they need one, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, most of the high stakes cases we work on, you know, I walk in, I look over to the other side, and, you know, I recognize, you know, the jury consultant.
Small world.
It's a small world, and our job is ultimately the same, really the same as any attorney's, which is just to, do your best for your client.
Absolutely. Well, I applaud what you do, and I really thank you for informing us all today. I've learned a lot, so thanks again, Steve.
Thanks to Steve Duffy. Thanks to you. You guys continue to delight and amaze me online with your insight and wit and care. Please check out our Facebook group, Deliberations Room, or find me on Twitter at Deliberation Pod. If anyone out there has special knowledge about jury sequestration, or any knowledge, I would be very interested in talking to you. Please email me at deliberationspod@gmail.com. I'm looking forward to digging in deeper to the relationship between Ava and Dr. Stowe with you. See you next Wednesday.